Today is Friday, April 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Myanmar's ousted leader appears virtually in court to face a new charge. Plus, Egypt says it's lost $1 billion from the closure of the Suez Canal.
And now this ship is under scrutiny, and they will not leave the Greater Lakes where they are being now kept until all investigations are done.
And the history of Washington's cherry blossoms. We'll have these stories and more next. Myanmar's ousted leaders Aung San Suu Kyi and President Win Myint appeared in good health during a court hearing Thursday, according to their lawyer. Both have been detained since the February 1st coup. Min Minso, who is representing the deposed leaders, said that she was not able to inform them about what is happening outside, and it's not clear if they're aware of the current situation in Myanmar. She also told reporters that she has not been allowed to meet her clients in person. In addition to the previous charges she's facing, Suu Kyi has now been charged with breaking a colonial-era official secrets law. It's the most serious charge against a veteran opponent of military rule and carries a sentence of up to 14 years in prison if convicted. Her trial is scheduled to resume on April 12. In a new measure to limit communication, the junta has now ordered internet service providers to shut down wireless broadband services until further notice. Protesters in Myanmar are marking 2 months since the military seized power again, defying the threat of lethal violence and demonstrating against its toppling of the country's democratically elected government. Protests were held on Thursday in several cities, including Yangon. Security forces have been unable to stop the massive public resistance to the coup despite their use of escalating violence, including routinely shooting protesters. UN Security Council President Ding Kwai Dong says,
"And number one priority now is to stop violence. And to stop violence, we have to make any effort to de-escalate the tension of own side. So I think that any measure have to take that into account. If it helps de-escalation, it helps stop violence, and if it creates favorable condition for dialogue among different sides and find out a satisfactory solution to the problem."
The crisis has expanded sharply in the past week, both in the number of protesters killed and with military airstrikes against minority guerrilla forces. A Hong Kong court has found 7 prominent Democrats guilty of unauthorized assembly charges. Reuters' Flora Bradley Watson has more.
The case is seen as the latest crackdown by China on its freest city after the imposition of a sweeping national security law last year. The 82-year-old barrister Martin Lee and media tycoon Jimmy Lai were among the defendants. Lee helped launch Hong Kong's largest opposition Democratic Party in the 1990s and is often referred to as the city's father of democracy. Another defendant, pro-democracy activist Lee Chuck Yun, spoke to reporters outside the court.
"In this day of reckoning, the political suppression is equally to all those who have taken part in the protest movement, including no matter whether you are the peaceful non-violence group or the braver, you are all caught under this political suppression wave."
The court case relates to a peaceful demonstration held on August the 18th in 2019, which grew into an unauthorized march as numbers swelled into the hundreds of thousands. During the trial, defense lawyers argued that freedom of assembly is a constitutional right in Hong Kong. But the district court judge said that that right was not absolute and argued that restrictions are imposed to preserve public safety and order. Sentencing will come later, with some legal experts expecting jail terms of 12 to 18 months. The maximum possible sentence is 5 years.
Flora Bradley Watson reports for Reuters News. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says, quote, "Their conviction is yet another example of Beijing eroding Hong Kong's freedoms and failing to live up to its international obligations," end quote. Egypt's Suez Canal Authority says the container ship that blocked traffic in the strategic waterway for nearly a week is being held with its crew while the investigation into the accident takes place. Egypt reportedly lost $1 billion from the closure of the canal and efforts to refloat the ship. Edward Uranian takes it from here.
The head of Egypt's Suez Canal Authority told journalists Thursday that the giant container ship Ever Given, which ran aground on March 23rd, blocking international shipping traffic in the strategic waterway, is being held in the Bitter Lakes region along the canal while an investigation continues with the ship's captain and crew. Usama Rabia added that he believes Egypt incurred $1 billion in damages from the accident. He lauded the experts and salvage crews that worked to free the ship. He says that our talented manpower is the most important capital that the Canal Authority possesses. It is the backbone of our operation, both in Egypt and internationally, and in these difficult circumstances, we have also relied on financial experts as well. Saeed Sadek, who teaches political sociology in Cairo, says investigators urgently need to find the causes of the accident.
If it is not done, then you will be in trouble. Because in this case, according to international law, in the Suez Canal law, the goods will be confiscated. And so that if there is anything inside, it will be revealed. If there are children, if there are nuclear bombs, anything will be revealed.
The ship is expected to be detained for 2 weeks. Sadek says both Egyptian and international investigators are at work on the case.
And now this ship is under scrutiny, and they will not leave the Greater Lakes where they are being now kept until all investigations are done. There has to be agreement who will pay the damages. We are talking about billions of dollars that will be paid.
Dr. Paul Sullivan, a professor at Washington-based U.S. National Defense University, tells VOA that it is normal procedure for Egypt and the Suez Canal Authority to seek compensation for the accident, but adds that with expected negotiations and court proceedings, it could take a long time for the matter to be settled. Egyptian Prime Minister Mustafa Madbouly told a cabinet meeting Thursday that despite the negative implications of the canal accident, it also highlighted the importance Egypt plays in world trade, along with the importance of the Suez Canal as a major world trade artery. Qatar's Al Jazeera TV reported that 81 ships have gone through the Suez Canal during the past 24 hours, and 163 ships have sailed through since the canal reopened Monday. Nearly 300 others are still waiting for their turn. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. Pharmaceutical giant Pfizer's got some new information about its coronavirus vaccine. AP correspondent Rita Foley reports.
Pfizer says its ongoing study finds its vaccine is 100% effective against severe disease, 91% effective against symptomatic disease, even 6 months after the second dose. And there are no serious safety concerns, says Pfizer, which made the announcement with its partner, BioNTech. The companies say the vaccine also appears to work against a variant first detected in South Africa. The Pfizer vaccine is authorized for those 16 years old and older. I'm Rita Foley.
A new study warns developing countries will have difficulty recovering from the devastating impact of the COVID-19 pandemic without relief from crushing debt burdens, keeping them mired in poverty. The United Nations Development Program is releasing a study ahead of next week's World Bank International Monetary Fund meetings. Lisa Schlein has that story.
The UN study finds 120 low- and middle-income economies will owe more than $1 trillion in debt service payments this year. It reports 72 countries, classified as vulnerable, are responsible for more than half that accumulated debt. UNDP Administrator Achim Steiner says these 72 countries are facing sovereignty or liquidity challenges that will crowd out important socioeconomic expenditures crucial for the well-being of their people.
We need bold new mechanisms. These are urgently needed to help low- and middle-income countries address crippling debt, which has been sharply worsened by COVID-19 and which will prevent vital investments to tackle poverty and climate change for years to come. Investments that we are seeing in a number of wealthier countries now playing out and unfolding. The service of public debt crowds out room for these investments in developing countries.
Steiner says most of the advanced economies are looking forward to a rapid recovery from the pandemic this year. However, the same cannot be said for the poorer countries. He says they are facing increasing poverty as COVID-19 continues to wreak havoc with the physical and economic health of their societies. He says a number of wealthier countries are investing significant amounts of money in stimulus packages to tackle the pandemic and boost their economies. He says similar investments are needed in developing countries, adding they would be transformative. For example, he says funding in Africa could help the continent recover from the pandemic based on green energy technology.
There are, as of this year, still 600 million people on the African continent that have no access to electricity. Nothing would be simpler than to drive a recovery and an energy transition with a significant investment in renewable energy infrastructure, helping to both accelerate development on the African continent and accelerate the transition towards a clean energy infrastructure for what will soon be 2 billion people on the African continent by the middle of this century.
UNDP economists say debt distress and vulnerability do not just threaten the poorest countries. They say middle-income countries and small island states also are buckling under heavy debt burdens. They urge delegates attending next week's World Bank IMF meeting to agree to provide liquidity support to all seriously indebted countries. Given the magnitude of the crisis, they say a combination of debt restructuring, additional financing, and reforms are needed. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Botswana's president says member states of the Southern African Development Community will respond in a meaningful manner to the deadly Islamist insurgency in northern Mozambique. President Mokgweetsi Masisi made the comments Wednesday after a meeting with Zimbabwe's President Emmerson Mnangagwa. Columbus Muvhunga reports.
Botswana President Mokgweetsi Masisi told reporters late Wednesday he talked to his South African counterpart Cyril Ramaphosa about the deteriorating situation in northern Mozambique prior to his arrival in Harare. At the State House in Harare, Masisi said his talk with Zimbabwe's President Emmerson Mnangagwa was dominated by the situation in Mozambique.
I have reported to President Mnangagwa the contents of my discussions with President Ramaphosa, and we have formed views as a troika. One of them will result in taking this further so that we as SADC respond in a helpful manner to ensure that we assure the integrity and sovereignty of one of our own, never to be assaulted by dissident, rebellious, state actor forces that undermine the democratic potential of peace and freedom.
Since 2017, an Islamist insurgency has raged in Mozambique's oil-rich Cabo Delgado province, calling it an acute crisis. UNICEF said this week that approximately 350,000 children have been displaced since the insurgency began. The Children's World Board said there's a cholera outbreak underway and COVID-19 is spreading as well. Adriano Nuvunga is a coordinator of the Mozambique Human Rights Defenders Network. Speaking from Maputo via a messaging application, Nuvunga said what is happening in the Cabo Delgado province is barbaric and SADC must quickly come in.
So it's quite disturbing to see that SADC is silent, is doing nothing. Since the Troika meeting in Harare last May, and when they promised to come forth and support Mozambique, nothing has happened, and Mozambique is resorting to international mercenary companies, which are committing all sorts of brutalities, human rights abuse, and some war crimes. So I think SADC is not doing enough.
Tendaiwo Peter Marege is with Coventry University's Center for Trust, Peace and Social Relations in England. He says all SADC leaders must call for another meeting and come up with a more specific program for Mozambique.
That program of action must have deliverables and actionable points of what sort of outcomes does SADC require or look up to following the intervention. It must also provide regional collaborative intervention strategies with the East African community, given that there's a likelihood that the conflict may spill over into Tanzania, Malawi, and therefore that regional competitive approach must also inform the program of action.
SADC does not have a standing army, unlike the West Africa bloc, ECOWAS. In the past, individual countries have deployed their armies to quell security threats in other member countries. Zimbabwe sent troops to the Democratic Republic of Congo and in Mozambique in the 1980s and in 1998, respectively, while South Africa deployed to quell post-election violence in Lesotho. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
The trial of white former police officer Derek Chauvin in the killing of African-American George Floyd last May continued in Minneapolis, Minnesota Thursday with testimony from Floyd's girlfriend, Reuters reporter Lisa Bernhard.
Courtney Ross was the first person who actually knew Floyd to testify at the trial of ex-Minneapolis cop Derek Chauvin, who was accused of killing Floyd last May.
I cannot breathe.
She was also open about how she and Floyd both struggled with opioid addiction.
Our story, it's a classic story of how many people get addicted to opioids.
In a central dispute of the trial, Chauvin's lawyers have argued that Floyd's death, ruled a homicide at the hands of police, was really an overdose caused by the fentanyl found in his blood. EMS worker Seth Bravender said when he and his partner arrived outside Cup Foods, where Floyd was suspected of passing a fake $20 bill earlier, police were on top of Floyd, who appeared to be not breathing and had no pulse. His first thought was that some kind of struggle was going on, but it quickly became clear that Floyd was limp.
Did you see a struggle of any kind going on, any movement, anything like that?
No.
It's been an emotional first week of testimony, as at least three eyewitnesses to the incident have broken down in tears, including passerby Charles McMillan, one of the first to notice Floyd's arrest.
I feel helpless.
Chauvin has pleaded not guilty to murder and manslaughter charges.
Reuters' Lisa Bernhard. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Before the COVID pandemic hit, 82% of clinics in the landlocked southern African nation of Eswatini lacked hot running water. That has changed in the past 6 months with the installation of solar-powered water heaters in every single government clinic, opening up clean health facilities to some 10,000 people a day in a nation that has long struggled with building up infrastructure. VOA's Anita Powell brings us this story.
For more than a year, nurse Lindiwe Magongo has seen to the needs of 600 patients per week at her small clinic near the capital of Eswatini, the nation formerly known as Swaziland. Until very recently, she's fought both ordinary health issues and the global coronavirus pandemic without the most basic healthcare tool, clean, hot water. Doctors say hand washing, hygiene, and sanitation are key to curbing the spread of illness. The coronavirus has claimed nearly 700 lives in this nation of just over 1 million people. Until this month, the 92 government clinics in this mountainous nation lacked this critical tool. But in recent months, a multinational initiative has installed an outdoor solar-powered hand-washing station in every clinic. On a recent weekday, Magongo beamed at the new hand-washing station at the gate of her clinic. Dozens of Emiswati, as the people of Eswatini are called, had lined up before the clinic opened and were now filing in after washing their hands. It's not just a concrete structure consisting of a heavy sink and a durable solar water heater, she said, though it is literally that. To her, it represents possibility. Magongo says the hot water station is also used to clean the clinic and brew tea for staff. Patients can take water home if they like.
I would call it a sculpture, because for us it's going to be here for quite some time. We are saving a lot because this is economically accessible to use, no electricity failures, or even if we experience power cuts, this service continues to work. So in that sense, it is economical, and it's going to be here for quite some time. We are really, really grateful.
VOA asked Acting Prime Minister Tema Masuku what seems like an obvious question. Why didn't the government do this before? Why wait for foreign donors? He said it's not that easy for a cash-strapped government with limited manufacturing capabilities and unreliable electricity supply. When the pandemic hit, he said, Eswatini struggled to acquire basic items like masks.
One of the priorities was to build the clinics first, because you can't put the stuff here without clinics. As we were building the clinics, as we have 92 of them now, those public health facilities, the stakeholders came in, they wanted to assist, and we gladly accepted that. So everything is prioritized. Health is one of our major priorities, and this is why we thought building the clinics before we get the hot water would be ideal.
At her small clinic in Ezulwini, Magongo said it also breaks what she described as a stigma around hand washing.
Whenever we wash hands, it means we are going to eat. Going and washing hands all the time, it's an African. We grow up knowing that it's an African to keep on washing hands. Why? There's always that why. Why do you keep on washing your hands?
So how do you break the taboo? How do you break that?
This is going to break it. And COVID-19 has also helped us in breaking that.
A year ago, Australian solar energy entrepreneur Robert Fraser landed in Eswatini for 2 weeks of meetings. Then the pandemic struck. And as he sat in lockdown halfway across the world from his Sydney home, he thought, why not do something? In that year, his company, with extra funding from the German government, has installed 92 of these 3,500 stations.
There was a very obvious need, and we had the products, we had the relationships, the expertise to actually deliver a project that would really make a difference in a very short amount of time, and actually, to be frank, for a reasonably small amount of money.
Fraser stresses that he's not running a charity. They're a for-profit company, and this project has paved the path for a $100 million solar storage project in Eswatini. Health Minister Lizzie Nkosi says hand hygiene is a key weapon against the infection, and one that Eswatini needs while it launches its mass vaccination campaign in the coming weeks.
It's not only bringing hot water in places where we would never have dreamt we would have hot water, but it's reinforcing age-old infection prevention measures that the ministry employs every time, whether we have an outbreak of measles, of diarrhea, an outbreak.
Don't take clean, hot water for granted, she said. Anita Powell, VOA News, Lubamba, Eswatini.
The record-breaking sale of digital artwork in March is part of a rush to invest in previously unmarketable things like basketball highlights, video game art, and even tweets. Making this possible are NFTs or non-fungible tokens. Matt Dibble explains.
Despite taking place online, the final moments of a recent Christie's art auction were dramatic. An artwork had just sold for nearly $70 million. Even the artist, Mike Winkelmann, was stunned.
It's like an unfathomable number, to be quite honest. It's just crazy.
It's the third highest amount ever paid for a work by a living artist. And even more extraordinary, the work is digital, with no real physical presence other than a digital file. Every Days, the first 5,000 days, is a collage of 5,000 images made one per day over a period of 13 and a half years by Winkelmann, who uses the name Beeple. Over the years, Beeple has shared these images freely on social media. So how does an artwork go from free to worth millions overnight? The secret ingredient is something called a non-fungible token, or NFT. NFTs use blockchain technology, but unlike other forms of cryptocurrency, each NFT is unique. Attaching an NFT to an artwork is a way to authenticate it with a digital signature. Digital artist Jonathan Monahan has also sold work using NFTs.
The hardest thing about being a digital artist has always been trying to get people to get behind a unique artwork that exists only as a digital file.
Last year, the NFT Art Marketplace Foundation approached Monahan about joining its roster of artists.
When I started this back in October, it was pretty quiet. There was only a dozen or so artists doing this. It's incomprehensible how much this blew up in the past 2 months.
NFTs have been around for about 3 years and are now being used to sell everything from basketball highlights, digital objects from video games, and even a tweet. The big players in the NFT field tend to be cryptocurrency insiders. Both the winner and the next highest bidder in the Beeple auction own crypto-related businesses. And though the auction was held by the old world auction house Christie's, the artwork was paid for using the Ether cryptocurrency. Like the rest of the rapidly evolving crypto world, NFTs present risks to both artists and collectors, warns investigative journalist Amy Castor.
An NFT doesn't really give you anything. It's just a token, and the only value of that is speculative. That is what somebody else is willing to pay you for it. What happens is when you get all this attention and excitement around NFTs is that more real money gets funneled into the cryptocurrency system. Then the people that have been holding those cryptocurrencies for a while can then cash out.
For Monahan, who says he has researched the crypto world, the potential benefits of using NFTs outweigh the risks.
A digital art is finally getting the recognition that it deserves, and that there's a lot of important artistic voices that are now being heard that were not being supported before.
Matt Dibble for VOA News.
And finally, spring has arrived in the Washington, D.C. area, and with it, the Tidal Basin's iconic cherry blossoms. But where did they come from?
My name is Brad Berger. I'm a ranger with the United States National Park Service. I work in Washington, D.C. at National Mall Memorial Parks. The cherry blossoms are a phenomenon that happens every spring as they bloom in the park. The chief spots, of course, are in this developed area beyond the Washington Monument around what is known as the Tidal Basin, which frames East and West Potomac Park. The Tidal Basin is in between these two bodies of land that were dredged from the Potomac River in the late 19th century, creating these buffers to prevent Washington from flooding as badly as it did in the better part of its first century. The cherry blossoms were a gift from Tokyo to Washington, and it was seen as a gift of goodwill that we today are able to enjoy. The cherry trees that we see in Washington as we walk around the Tidal Basin and around the Washington Monument grounds, these trees are, for the most part, the grandsons and granddaughters of the original gift. That's one of the things that we like to convey to people when they visit the park during cherry blossom time is treat the trees gently, for we only have a handful of the original trees left, and it takes cuttings from these trees to create new ones. People climbing on them and impacting the ground around the root systems have, unfortunately, over time led to the replacement of some of the original trees with cuttings from others to grow new ones. It's a park that has millions of visitors every year coming to visit, to pay tribute to our country's past, to check out the architecture. Some people come to see the way that monuments have developed over time, from the obelisk form of the Washington Monument all the way up to the Vietnam Wall, the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial, World War II Memorial. Now we have the new Eisenhower Memorial on Independence Avenue.
You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other electronic device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.